Welcome to our panel on decolonizing the sociology of gender and sexualities. I want to just welcome you today, and I want to thank our three speakers. I'm going to just briefly introduce each of them. Each of them will give a presentation of about 12 minutes, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So first of all, we have Raewyn Connell, is an Australian sociologist, currently Professor Emerita at the University of Sydney and a life member of the National Tertiary Education Union in Australia. Sorry, I don't know why I can't say that word. Raewyn is author, a co-author of 24 books, and she has given public lectures and keynote addresses in 30 countries. Her research has addressed a wide range of questions about society, including studies on class structures, inequality in education, teachers and their work, sexuality in the HIV pandemic, the making of masculinities, health inequalities, the neoliberal market agenda, large-scale gender patterns, the intellectual workforce, and knowledge systems on a world scale. So it's so impressive. Next, we have Vaishali Patel, is Associate Professor of Sociology and Chair of the Department of Global and Sociocultural Studies at Florida International University. She writes and teaches at the intersection of gender and sexuality studies, post-colonial and decolonial studies, and historical sociology. She has published in ethnic and racial studies, sociological theory, signs, theory of society, and gender and society, among other journals. Her forthcoming book is Web Connectivities, The Imperial Sociology of Sex, Gender, and Sexuality, coming out this year, 2022, with the University of Minnesota Press. So congratulations, Vaishali, on the book. I'm so excited to read it. And we have Carolyn Chope, is a PhD candidate of the Joint Research Group, Migration, China, and the Global Context by the Max Weber Foundation and Hong Kong Baptist University. Setting Migration Studies into Dialogue with Decolonial Approaches, her PhD project comparatively analyzes labor market privilege of white women, Western migrants in Hong Kong. Her work has been published in international journals. She has also convened the 2017 and 2018 workshops, Global South Perspectives Towards Decolonization, De-stratification, and Decentralization of Social Knowledge Production, and has been serving as guest editor at Third World Quarterly and Social Transformations, Journal of the Global South. So also a very impressive record for a young scholar. So thank you all three for being here. I will give it over to you. I'll just kind of keep time, and I'll just put I'll just put my finger up when you have 1 minute left. Does that sound good? So I'll give it over to Raewyn. Thank you, Raewyn.
Okay, thank you very much. Greetings to everyone from Australia in the southwest, from Sydney in the southwest Pacific region. Let me just attempt the amazing technological feat of sharing my screen. Share. Hope that's coming through. And I will even more amazingly go full screen, I hope. So the problem we're discussing today now has a good deal of attention in the academic world, but it's by no means a new problem, not even in the area of gender. The first picture I want to show you is a shot of an Algerian feminist, whom some of you will know, Mania Lazric, who some 30 years ago published a powerful article about the dilemmas of feminism in Algeria, Muslim North Africa, in which she remarked that there is to quote her, a significant error in feminist scholarship. The significant error became a very practical issue for Algerian feminists, she argued, who had in fact two battles to fight, one against the patriarchal men in their own society, The other against the dominance of European North American thought in the world of feminism. And that era of global dominance by a particular region and perspectives has persisted, of course, and has deep historical roots. And we're affected by it, especially in the university world, because all the disciplinary knowledge formation, including new areas of study like gender studies, gender sociology, so forth, are embedded in a global system of production and exchange of knowledge in which there is a global division of labor with the colonized and post-colonial world functioning mainly in this economy as source of raw materials, a sort of data. And most of the work of theorization, of the accumulation of information, interpretation, the creation of applied knowledge happening in the global north, and especially being controlled by the elite knowledge institutions of the global north, the elite universities, research institutes, journal publishers, and the like. Now, this is a very general feature of the contemporary state of the knowledge economy, and it applies in feminist research too. So that if you look at the journals that are produced in the global periphery, where 6 out of 7 of the world's people live, you'll find that most of the theoretical concepts, the research methods, and so forth, are those which have been developed in those institutions in the global north, even though the data, the information, the practical experience will come from local societies. That is absolutely typical of the human and natural and social sciences and natural sciences too, in the disciplinary knowledge system. And that becomes important for substantively for us because the pattern of global empires and post-colonial, post-imperial, global inequalities of resources, power, authority, and so forth are gendered. Empire is a gendered historical pattern. That becomes obvious as soon as we look at the process of imperial conquest, the process of colonization, the structure of power and economic processes in the original empires and then in the post-colonial global economy that we live in today. And one of the features of colonization and its consequences was the transformation of gender orders in colonized societies, producing new gender patterns in colonial societies, which then, of course, became the historical basis of post-colonial gender patterns. And it's not surprising, since most of those gender patterns were patriarchal, that there were feminist responses. So we have a whole history of feminist responses in the colonized world, in colonial societies, which I illustrate with just one case, the picture of Huda Sharawi, one of the organizers of feminist activism in Egypt 100 years ago. But I could give many other examples, and I'm sure many of the people here could. Okay, well, that is a very sudden sketch of the issue that we're facing, in fact, that our field of research and teaching has a colonial history and one that has affected the structure of the field on a global scale. So how do we respond to this? What do we do? Well, what I want to emphasize as a sociologist and as a teacher is the practical character of the problem and of the responses we should be making. So I want to suggest three in particular, three tasks that we face in decolonization of a field such as the sociology of gender and sexuality. They are, first of all, this is my battle plan, so to speak. They are firstly remaking the agendas in the field, agendas of research, the agendas that shape curriculum, and the agendas of theory. We need to tap the resources of the majority world to reconstruct a field which is currently shaped by the massive historical and present inequalities. Secondly, and this is something I particularly emphasize when I'm talking about these issues, because it's not a focus of current intellectual debate, we need to widen the workforce that is involved in the production and circulation of knowledge. And that means, among other things, pressing to expand the resources that are available in the university systems of the global South, broadly understood. We need to support the development of knowledge practices in the communities that are affected by the inequalities in the global economy. And we need to take note of and support the social movements that are transforming those post-colonial gender orders and which have needs for knowledge resources as they have needs for practical and material resources. And finally, this is close to home for academics like me, we need to remake knowledge institutions themselves, which are affected by coloniality, as Aníbal Quijano argued, for the whole institutional structure of colonial and post-colonial society, that coloniality continues in the post-colonial world. And this is absolutely true of universities, as I see when I look around in Australia. We're seeing universities tied into a subordinate position in the global economy. And that applies to freestanding research institutes and NGOs. It applies to social movements as well. We need to remake the knowledge production means, the means of knowledge production around the global periphery. Now, what resources have we got for this? There's huge dilemmas about the material resources, of course, because of the scale of inequalities, even in the university system, is rarely adequately understood. When you make a serious comparison of the resources available to elite institutions in the global north, and even mainstream institutions, not even the poorest institutions in the global south, the scale of material inequality is huge. But since we have limited time, I want to focus a little bit on the intellectual resources that are available for the kind of transformation we are talking about. Some that come from those social movements in post-colonial societies that have been transforming post-colonial gender orders. And here, I'm screen sharing and I'm trying to move. No, it doesn't want to move. And I'm not quite sure what to do with that. Well, I'll have to do without the images, I'm afraid, as the technology isn't working properly. Let me unshare and try sharing again. Ah, thank you. For instance, one can use, and I'm sure many of us already are using, the resources that have come from activists in feminist organizations in post-colonial societies. And I give again just one example from a large literature, the work of Julieta Kirkwood, one of the leaders of resistance to the dictatorship in Chile. The work of Teresita de Barbieri, originally from Uruguay, later in Mexico, who developed amazing accounts of the gender orders regionally across Latin America. The work of people like Bina Agarwal, enormously important gender theorist from India, working in on issues of land and environment. The work of people like Copano Ratele, one of the most interesting contemporary thinkers about masculinity studies. And I could go on for an hour, as I'm sure many of us could. So in a way, many of the resources are already there. It's up to us essentially to connect them and to deploy them. So I finish with this lovely image from a cover of a book written by my colleague, Chilla Bulbeck, just a bit over 20 years ago, about this problem of decentering feminist thought by connecting up, in her word, braiding at the borders between the ideas of different feminist movements around the world. That is the kind of cooperation we need for intellectual work for gender justice. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Raymond. That was quite an inspirational talk to give us lots of thoughtful objectives for thinking about global justice and how to decolonize gender and sexuality. I appreciate those words. Let me now turn it over to Vrushali.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining today. And I want to thank Melanie for this invitation. It's exciting for me to be here, part of this conversation. I am a US-based scholar, originally from India. And I begin by locating myself in this way because I think it's important for thinking about how what you are allowed to say in sociology is shaped by where you are, right? As well as the type of body you inhabit. The US is the heart of empire, which gives concrete advantages to some of the speakers located there. But my experiences, I think, also point to the tensions and limits of the speech. So just a quick example. As a graduate student, I recall being mistaken for an international student. I'm not, which I think emanates from the association of Americanness with whiteness. And I remember being invited to join, you know, foundation-funded projects on population and development in the so-called developing world, which is a major way in which sociology has made space for particularly Black and Brown people in the developing world. You know, these sorts of funds are about inviting people from the developing world to learn about population management and control, and then the assumption is that people are going to go back to their countries and contribute to those efforts there. I chafed at being put in my assumed place in this way. However, I learned that the things that I did want to write about, coloniality, gender, sexuality, and theory on these topics, was not acceptable. I could provide data, as Raywin talked about. I could become an authentic insider. I could write about underdevelopment and something called the status of women. But theory was not supposed to come from my body. The issue of who is allowed to say what, I think, is intimately connected to the politics of what is legible in US-based sociology. And I think it's important to talk about US-based sociology, even in the ISA, because of its outsized influence, right, in global networks of knowledge production. So what I want to spend some time on today is the colonial politics of legibility in US-based sociology. Some of you recently heard me talk about this. You're going to hear it again. And legibility is important because legibility is about the ability to be read or deciphered, especially with ease, right? Legibility is about being recognized. Legibility has cognitive and affective components. We don't just recognize certain objects as more readily when they're legible. There's also a sense of familiarity and comfort with certain ways of reading and recognizing those objects. So I want to highlight three interrelated ways in which this colonial politics of legibility is constituted in US sociology. One is history and the politics of time. Two is the erasure of space. Three is the assumption of scale. And then I'm going to end with an introduction of just some tools, kind of a humble offering on my part, that I suggest can help us to interrupt this colonial politics of legibility in US feminist sociology. Okay, history and the politics of time. So I'm going to begin with some really basic, well-known facts you can find on the internet. And most of us already know, all of us probably already know, between 1492 and 1914, a handful of European countries and the United States conquered or colonized about 80% of the world, right? If we include outright colonization, as well as protectorates, mandates, even spheres of influence, something like five countries in the world are spared. The bulk of countries on the continents of Africa and Asia received their formal political independence only after World War II. There are still territories that do not have political independence, and legal decolonization did not return stolen lands to indigenous peoples for the most part either. So the point here is that the history of colonization, various forms of what we might imperfectly call incomplete decolonization, is perhaps the major event of the so-called modern world, right? Prompting people like Maria Lagunas to talk about something called colonial modernity. And yet, if the colonial is a major event of modernity, it's one which US feminist sociology has not adequately addressed and often not even recognized, right? So that it's actually erased from what we understand simply as modernity. And a number of scholars have talked about how though sociology emerged in the European context in the midst of colonial processes, that sociological theorizing has eschewed the colonial. In the US context, I think the problem is even worse because the US routinely accepts itself from even these histories, right? And the general ahistoricism of our discipline makes the problem even worse. So there's a politics of time and history in US-based feminist sociology where we have erased the colonial from the colonial modern. Okay, a second related contributor to this colonial politics of legibility is the erasure of space. The US has always been a part of the Club of Empires and an important contributor to colonial knowledges, though the character of this contribution has changed over time. While initially in a subordinate position within trans-imperial networks in the time of British hegemony, from World War I, the US would ascend to global hegemonic status itself. And part of the way hegemony works is that the hegemon's specific views and interests are represented as the views and interests of everyone. For the US from World War I, global hegemony has been about shaping international institutions as well as knowledge production. So US feminist sociology then is a knowledge formation with power in a broader global field. The erasure of space in the context of global hegemony is about how US sociology represents itself as producing aspatial, generalizable, globally relevant, and even foundational knowledge, even as it perpetuates US specific colonial knowledges. And again, there's so many different ways to talk about this, but we can take a really, really simple example. If we take a look at the titles on gender scholarship, work that's produced in Mexico or in South Africa will have those qualifiers in the title. It will say something like gender in South Africa. In contrast, work that's produced on the US, especially if it involves white bodies, tends to have no such qualifiers. It's just about gender, full stop. Which reproduces the hegemony of US-based knowledge production. It's knowledge that is located and situated, but it presents itself as general. The third contributor to this colonial politics of legibility is politics of scale. The sociologist John Logan has talked about how particular scales of analysis are taken for granted in particular substantive areas of sociology. In US feminist sociology, the taken for granted scale of analysis is the state, which is often coterminous with society or culture. This is certainly how early feminist sociologists imagined the social construction of gender as occurring at the scale of society, which overlapped with the state or culture. Imagining gender as varying by society or culture or the state in this way, feminist sociologists could then compare the social construction of gender across time and space to make the case that gender is not essential but constructed. And, you know, there are, of course, many processes that occur at the level of the state, for example, having to do with state policy and politics, right? And these matter for social construction. The problem with scaling gender to society or the state in this way, or with making the state scale the taken for granted scale, is that it elides processes that occur at other scales, right? It can take processes which occur at more local scales, at the level of the community, for example, and scale them up to the state or disappear them altogether. And it can erase or elide the cross-border. So the politics of time and history, the erasure of space and spatial locatedness, and the politics of scale together constitute a colonial politics of legibility, which does a number of things. It erases histories of empire and colonialism that have connected different so-called societies for centuries, right? Severing and erasing the colonial from the modern. It compels us to track social phenomena at the default scale of the state. And if we pay attention to change over time, we're paying attention to change over time at the scale of the state emptied of colonial content. And it invisibilizes the hegemonic status of the US and its knowledge formations. And so in particular sites, forms the bounds of what seems and feels like a legitimate arena of inquiry. So what I want to end with is a very brief sort of set of suggestions on how we can interrupt this colonial politics of legibility in US-based feminist sociology, which then also, I think, ends up mattering for sociologies elsewhere. This is based on the forthcoming book that Melanie mentioned earlier. First, interrupting the colonial politics of legibility involves reconfiguring our notion of the social from something coterminous with the state to what I call webbed connectivities. Webbed connectivities point to the dense histories of connection or networks constituted by processes and structures of empire, slavery, and colonialism since at least the 16th century. Critically, webbed connectivities are multi-scalar. And this is important. Taking on a webbed connectivities framework does not mean only looking at the cross-border or the transnational. It means engaging in a multi-scalar analysis where the cross-border and the transnational is not an afterthought. It means centering the relationships between and among multiple scales of analysis. And in the book, I show how imperial web connectivities matter, not just for experiences and subjectivities, but for the constitution of the very categories of sex, gender, and sexuality since the early modern period. And in order to explore web connectivities, I offer what I call the methodological tactic of thinking sideways. And thinking sideways very simply is tracking the processes which constitute web connectivities across received borders. So instead of choosing a site and examining phenomena that unfold over time within that site, we track relations and processes that cross receive sites, bringing together sites of analysis that are not intended to be brought together in this way. The tactic of thinking sideways can be an epistemologically difficult and affectively uncomfortable process. However, if comfort is itself shaped by the colonial politics of legibility, then discomfort might be what we need to disrupt that politics. So ultimately, I argue that thinking sideways across multi-scale or webbed connectivities can help us challenge the erasure of the colonial and to recenter the colonial as a fundamental event, condition, and character of modernity. for the US, the ideologies and structures that helped consolidate the settler colonial slaving state, its exercise of global hegemony since World War I, and its current experience of imperial decline are all intimately shaped by gender, sexuality, and sex. And so I'm arguing that what I'm offering here, I'm running out of time, are important tools for making the colonial visible and for pushing the bounds of legibility in US-based feminist sociology, for opening up then who is allowed to speak, the spaces from which we're allowed to speak, and finally, what we are allowed to say.
Just getting my, thank you so much, Vaishali. I think these two presentations really complement each other in wonderful ways, and thinking about some very specific steps that we can take in considering how to decolonize sociology in general, but in particular thinking about that space of gender and sexuality. So let me now turn it over to Carolyn.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor to be on this panel with giants in the field like Vaishali and Raven. So thank you so much for having me here. Put this full screen. So I was thinking what would be of interest here, and my own research might be a bit boring, so I might focus on introducing the modernity coloniality framework and the framework of the coloniality of gender by Maria Lugones mostly, but I might, if I have time, I might look into my own research a little bit at the very end. And this can really also exemplify if previous speakers have said, voices are being silenced and privileged voices are being centered. What exactly do we mean by that? What are some concrete instances of what is being silenced or centered? So the modernity coloniality school holds that through colonialism, a colonial matrix of power was created that started out spanning the metropoles and the colonized countries, and as almost all countries in the world were colonized, basically spanning the whole world, and that these colonial axes of power continue even after so-called political decolonization. That means we are still living in a world of colonial structures. So the meaning of colonialism first was that a huge amount of wealth and resources was stolen or extracted, for example, through slave labor, through stealing of resources from the colonized world through Europe and later to settler colonies. So as the other speakers were talking about development, this is the instant where Europe was developed. So Europe was developed on the basis of stealing resources from the rest of the world. Colonialism also meant imposing racial categories to colonized populations. And the reason for this was often to exploit, to justify exploiting their labor. So whites were doing wage labor, whereas non-white populations were categorized as inferior and categorized, or it was justified that they could be enslaved or could be subjected to indentured labor, other forms of exploitative labor practices due to their inferiority. So there is this connection of race or racialization and capitalism, global capitalism here that served Europeans and then whites. and then of course, gender and the European ideas of gender, including heterosexualism, what Lugones calls heterosexualism, patriarchy and European gender norms were imposed to colonized people who often had more egalitarian and less restrictive understandings of gender and sexualities, right? And even after decolonization, these relations continue, and the coloniality of power framework assumes multiple power relations and hierarchies, including economic, political, racial or ethnic, gender, sexual, religious, epistemic or academic, linguistic and religious, and a lot of other power relations. So they really see this as a matrix of power that spans the globe, and where Europe and the settler colonies are privileged on these axes of powers, and people in underdeveloped countries are oppressed among them. Yeah. So, of course, as Raven also pointed out, this goes hand in hand with academic imperialism and the coloniality of power, coloniality of knowledge. And as Roshali also said, academic knowledge production and, of course, also lay knowledge production centers positions of those privileged, privileged economically, privileged by racialization, privileged by gender, and so on. And their knowledges and views are centered also in the sociology of gender and sexualities, in general sociology, and in everyday knowledges, the voices and perspective of the privileged are centered. Okay, so I want to talk about the Argentinian feminist philosopher Maria Lugones and her idea of coloniality of gender as an example of what exactly colonialism meant for how they impacted gender or ideas of gender across the world and in the colonized countries, right? So Lugones criticizes Western feminism as having an ahistorical understanding of gender and a lack of understanding of how colonialism impacted gender and sexualities. And she argues that colonialism imposed Western and racialized gender norms on colonized people. Yeah, as I said, many of whom had practiced gender in more fluid and more egalitarian ways before that. Right. So she goes through different works of how gender had been done in pre-colonial times in, for example, among Native Americans in Africa. And I also want to include the work of Phoebe Sanchez, who also works on pre-colonial gender norms in the Philippines. And she says gender was sometimes assigned much more fluidly, for example, based on inclination, temperament, what one dreamt of as being, and not strictly on biology. There was often a recognition of intersex or third gender individuals. A lot of societies were matriarchal or egalitarian. There were often female deities, and homosexuality and lesbianism were often recognized or positively appraised. And female sexualities, as Sanchez argues, were also much less restrained by norms. Females could practice their sexuality much more freely. And of course, then Western colonialism, as Lugones argues, impacted Western heterosexualism, which included, for example, the understanding of gender in narrowly biological terms, the imposition of the patriarchy hierarchy, the subordination of females to males. This means that a lot of females lost the political rights they previously held in pre-colonial societies, were excluded from leadership positions, lost control over property and access to economic domains, lost freedoms like choosing their who they want to marry, choosing the right to bear, losing the right to bear arms, were imagined as cognitively inferior and were subordinated to men. And also that intersex individuals were now corrected or assumed to have to be corrected to fit one sex. There was an imposition of the Christian God, which of course is male instead of female. And there was an imposition of compulsive heterosexuality and shaming of homosexual individuals, of course, and imposition of norms on how females had to be chaste. And of course, not all genders were, like gender was not imposed in an uniform way by Western colonialism, but it was highly racialized. For example, white women were seen as fragile, in need of shelter, whereas non-white women were seen in much more negative ways, viewed as similar to animals, and often subjected to race or rape or sexual exploitation and so on. Right, so Lugones basically criticizes feminism, saying that it is white-centric, and it theorizes as if all women were white bourgeois women, and basically says feminism is a type of feminism only for those who are oppressed by gender, but for those who are privileged by all access of power. So this is basically the content or the lived experience that mainstream feminism centers is people who are oppressed by gender but privileged on the basis of race, class or global social position, privileged on the basis of religion, culture and so on, language and so on, right? So what are the solutions? Some solutions that also the people here in ISA could be doing is that first we need to include and center rather than include women of color and women from the global south and women who are based and trained in the global south, both scholars, activists and lay people among our circles. So we need to hire them at northern universities. We need to grant them access to conferences. So we should not reject the abstracts because we don't think they're relevant for our audiences, which are of course northern white audiences. We should make conferences accessible in the sense that they must not be prohibitively expensive. We should include them in organizing committees so they can teach us how to make such conferences or organizations accessible. Should hire them in universities in non-exploitative tenure track or tenure positions. We must urgently rethink relevance, as Mushali also noted. At the moment in journals or in general, mostly only the experience of the privileged counts as relevant or as interesting for a general audience, whereas if a paper comes in that tries to detail the experience of the oppressed on a global scale, it's often described as too narrow, not interesting to the readers and stuff. So we're doing a very parochial sociology, as Syed Farid Alat has also said, that it's kind of a sociology of the privileged for the privileged, right? So women of color and women from the global south should also be included in journals, of course, in teaching materials and in lesson plans. Okay, I think I'm almost out of time, so I'll stop here and thank you so much.
Wonderful, thank you, Carolyn. You had a little bit more time, but that's great. I think it just leaves us a bit more time for discussion now. So thank you, I love the work of Maria Lagones and the thoughts on thinking of how to, you know, push our discipline forward, particularly the ISA, I think is a good place to start thinking about the ways to combat some of these colonial processes of knowledge production. So we have about 15 minutes for discussion. So I'll go ahead and open it up to our audience. You can either type questions in the chat or feel free to raise your hand and ask your question. Perhaps while people are sort of thinking about what they'd like to ask, maybe I will ask our presenters if they have any questions for each other at this point. I have a question that I'd love to ask, but I'd love to hear from you. What's that?
Go for it.
Okay, so I am I'm particularly interested in thinking about, the presentations all are getting us to think about research, teaching, all the ways that we perpetuate these systems of power. And I'm curious, given, you know, the very specific suggestions all of you have made, what kinds of suggestions you have in terms of knowledge production for teaching and how to go about decolonizing the way that we teach? I find this to be challenging at times. And so I'm wondering if you have some particular experiences or thoughts on that.
All right, I'll start. Quite a while ago, when I was teaching at Macquarie University, another university in Sydney, we had an introduction to sociology course in which a theme developed by my colleague Vivian Johnson was that Australia, which is settler colonial, principally a settler colonial society, that Australia is actually the site of two civilizations, the civilization brought by the settlers and the civilization of the indigenous peoples, which is a very ancient and complex set of cultures, something like 400 different languages, something that is hardly realized popularly today. So the course actually was framed as something about the meeting or interaction of civilizations on the land that we, the settlers, came to call Australia. And this involved bringing Indigenous tutors in to be with the students in the course. It involved our finding texts, not academic texts principally, but kind of life histories told in first person of Aboriginal people's experience of contemporary Australia, and beginning to set that in a context of the wider context of the imperial history that the contemporary society came out of. So that's just one example, an old one, in fact, of the kinds of things that can be done to shake up the assumption that there is only one way of looking at the world and only one experience of one's own society.
Rishali?
Yeah, I can say a little bit about that too. The way I've been teaching is I've been sort of, and you know, this sort of goes for multiple kinds of classes, is I just put the colonial context back in. You know, like I think with a lot of our published scholarship, it's just sort of not there for some reason, right? And I just put it back in, you know. So, you know, whether I'm teaching a sociological theory or I teach a race, gender, sexuality class where we start in the early modern period and we look at how they shape each other, right, in the context of kind of these racial projects over time and across space. And so I just put it back in. And in the process of that, then you're obviously, you have to bring in voices that have been erased and excluded, right? I mean, you can't have that happen without having all of those voices there. And it's just a completely different experience. I think it's also probably made easier because where I teach, we have such an international student body, you know, the graduate students and the undergraduate students. So we have, you know, we have students from the Caribbean and from Latin America and from Africa. And it's just, if I didn't do that, I think there would be, you know, there would be some really unhappy people from the get-go. So, so that's what I do. And it seems to work pretty well for me.
Thanks, Rishali. Yeah, Carolyn.
Yeah, thank you so much for this excellent question. I want to share two resources just for the people who sometimes are saying, how do I even start? Who do I read? So this is the excellent webpage of Global Social Theory. I think they're Gorminda Bambra. And then Syed Farid Alat has put together a textbook on a global theory class, which also lacks feminist and scholars and scholars of color, but to some extent it's a step into the first direction. So these are some resources. And I want to emphasize what we are teaching now is really a parochial, narrow, white Western sociology. So like what is missing is really what is completing the picture. So we wouldn't also obsess, like I need to teach Parson. If I don't teach Parson, like people will think I'm a failure. So we just need to teach a global sociology because that's the correct sociology and that is what will be regarded as correct in the future. So yeah, that's what we need to do.
Yeah, I agree. That's wonderful. Mindy.
Hello, thank you so much. I am very excited to be here because I've read almost everybody. I brought this up in my classical sociology class. I'm a first year master's student, and I ended up writing a very lengthy paper in my class, which I clashed with my classical theory professor over, which was about how can we dismantle this mythical canon that we teach as being as part of our foundation. And how can we change the culture within our discipline without alienating our peers? That was my question for the entire course for that class. I struggled a lot because when I talked to other professors, the response I've received and talked to a couple of my classmates in other institutions was that when they asked their own professors, they told us that it is because our prescribed learning outcomes are consistent, that if we are teaching the same material, we allow our students to have the same set of language so they can talk to our academic peers. That was kind of the general response. And the other one was that we have to learn Durkheim, Marx, and Weber as part of the canon because this is the tradition. We have a tradition within our discipline, and this is how we are taught. I caught this whole lecture and speech from multiple instructors where they said, I am the student in this field, and I studied under the father of so-and-so. I made a face because they could see me on camera. But how do we dismantle it without alienating others? And how can we do it in a welcoming approach that allows for broader discussion without that clash?
Can I start?
Sure.
with that? That is so real an issue. In fact, a lot of my work in the area began with exactly that issue of having to teach the three founding fathers and not believing the story at the time. Discovering when I looked into it, that that is a completely invented tradition. It was invented in the 1950s and 60s. It didn't exist in the time of so-called classical sociology itself. So it is a later fabrication, and we should know this. The discipline as a whole should know this. But in practical terms of how to establish alternatives, one of the things we do have to do is persuade our colleagues in the discipline that the intellectual work that comes from outside Europe and North America in aggregate, you know, is as powerful, as important, maybe more important than much of that comes from the global North. And that means that is not an easy thing to do, because it means inviting people to invest energy and time in getting to know people like some of those that I mentioned, you know, Agatha, Gopano, Telet, and so forth, writers from other contexts. Now, it is worth doing, but it's up to people who are, you know, beginning work in this area to persuade others that this matters intellectually. And professionally, too.
We have a question from Carla. Hi, Carla. It says, I would be interested in hearing from the panelists about some tips or strategies for moving forward with some of the agenda-setting practices that have been outlined during today's talks. In this particular moment of increasing neoliberalization and the bureaucratization of institutions of higher education, stifling hegemony and political assaults on knowledge and justice, and dwindling resources for knowledge production and programs, departments and schools that tend to focus on gender, sexuality, social inequality, and empire. So our other two speakers, if you have anything you would like to add for Mindy or this question here, and Raywin as well, if you have something you'd like to speak to here. Yeah, go ahead, Carolyn.
I just wanted to follow up on Mindy very quickly. So as Raywin already said, the what we think of as a canon now is really constructed, and its construction is based on exclusion of racialized scholars and scholars from the Global South. So two examples, for example, is W.E.B. Du Bois, had made a wonderful sociology that theorized race on a global scale and was really excluded and silenced and treated horribly by his peers because he was Black. And now people are slowly starting to bring him back more than 100 years after he wrote his work. The other example is Oliver Cromwell Cox, who did a very elaborate version of what would later be called world systems analysis and what would later be popularized by Wallerstein. But Cox had basically outlined a really intricate theory of global capitalism, in which race also played an important role. And his theory also was completely silenced because of racism. And now everything is attributed to Wallerstein, of course, complexified everything. So the canon is a racist canon, and it is based on exclusion. How to communicate this to professors without alienating? I alienated my professors, so I really don't know. But there are a lot of decolonial scholars who are also organizing workshops, organizing special issues, and organizing conferences and stuff. Will be very happy to support you. So you can just reach out to us, and we'll be so happy to give you any resources or advice that we have. Yeah.
So to address the other question about sort of how do we move forward with this in the current political climate, that's the question, right? I mean, things are just getting worse and worse. And I speak from Florida, which seems to be, you know, where some of the absolute worst stuff is happening, at least in the United States. I think that part of the answer is that people who have more privilege, who have to take the responsibility on some of this. You cannot sort of let students or junior faculty or people who don't have any protection in the system sort of, you know, but who are often the ones that are in some ways, you know, making the strongest sort of demands for more equity in terms of our knowledge in our production practices and in the structure of the university. Those people need support. And I think that sometimes more senior folks, people who actually have a little bit of protection, people who have risen up the ranks and are sort of feeling maybe a little bit comfortable, even though of course there's precarity everywhere, I think we need to take a little bit more responsibility for using our privilege to get into these fights, because it is getting, I think, you know, more and more disturbing and scary. And you know, and I mean, we can have our conversations, but this is the reality of what's going on, you know, all around our conversations. So it's really, really important. That's, you know, that's all I want to say there. I don't really have a full-blown response or solution, but that's what I have.
Well, it's 12 and I'm, well, here it's 12. It's it's all kinds of other times all over the world at this point. I don't know if any of our other speakers have a couple of final words they'd like to say in closing. Raywin, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, very briefly, the key to any kind of political struggle, and that's what we're facing, is solidarity. So connection, using the resources that are available in the form of organizations, unions matter in the academic world too. Look for, reach out connect, give support, and receive support. That's the kind of approach we need.
I completely agree. And, you know, it's wonderful. Thank you to all three of our speakers for sharing these perspectives, which is part of that solidarity and, you know, moving forward to bring us together to have these conversations. It's so important. And I especially want to say thank you to Raewyn for thinking of this idea. And I really think it's been an important conversation. We have it recorded, so we'll put it up on our RC230 website. So you can let people know if they're interested, they can hear the talks. Carolyn, do you have a final word you'd like to say?
Yeah, thank you so much for organizing this. And yeah, there's a lot that ISA especially can do in like helping women of color and women from underdeveloped countries to join and be able to join and center them there. So I'm very glad to see that at ISA, sorry, and I hope this is the start of a much bigger project. So thank you very much.
Thank you to all. Have a wonderful day, evening, morning, wherever you may be. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.